Hello everyone, my name is Francis Donald and I'd like to welcome you to this eighth session in an ongoing series of webinars on sacred number and geometry. I hope you're having a great new year so far. I want to extend a special welcome to students who have just joined the Moria Federation. Salutations and best luck with your studies this year. If you'd like to view any of the first seven of these webinars on sacred geometry, they are available on makara.us. That's makara.us. Okay. If you'd like to ask any questions or make a comment during the webinar, it's best if you have a headset, because otherwise we get an echo if you're just speaking into your computer. If you don't have a headset, there's a text box in the middle of your control panel that you can use to ask and answer questions. There's really only a couple of buttons that you need to concern yourself with. The main one is the raise your hand button. You see it there pointed to. It's up in the upper left corner of your control panel. Just click it once, and then Joe Waltz, who will be assisting me during this webinar, will be able to see that you would like to be called on. Okay, that's the button you'll use when I ask for people to read the various quotes, and I very much encourage you to step forward for as a reader. Nothing else will be asked of you, just to read the quotes that appear on your screen. So if you'd help me out, if you'd answer quickly, we can move the webinar along much more speedily. If you have any other questions about the GoToMeeting interface, feel free to type them in the text box and Joe will relay your questions to me. Okay, we have a lot to cover, so let's dive right in. Today we'll be discussing the esoteric side of the number four through two great concepts. First, the fall of three into four and the subsequent overshadowing of the latter by the former. And second, four as the midway point. The concept of three falling into four presents four as the lower quaternary, which represents denseness, separation, and the field of service for the disciple. Four as the midway point reveals four as an environment for release from this separation. It's somewhat fitting that we've had a two-month break between the first and seven webinars, which focused on the numbers 1 through 3, and this new series of webinars that will start today with the number 4. 1 through 3 are causal numbers. With the number 4, we move from two dimensions to three, from the inner to the outer, from formlessness to form, and thus from the unmanifest to the realms of effect, called in esoteric parlance the lower quaternary. Transitions between numbers are like verbs. They are dynamic and phohatic. Often the first number in a two-number series disappears into the second, but informs and overshadows that second number, kind of like the qualities of the triangle determine the nature of the four-sided tetrahedron. The transitions between the first three numbers signify fundamental cosmic shifts. For instance, the transition from 1 to 2 represents the beginning of periodic manifestation following pralaya, a period of cosmic rest, which HPB describes as the reign of the dark mystery of non-being. The realms of 1 and 2 present to us some of our most profound philosophical questions. But because we live and identify with the form world of form, the transition we're looking at today from 3 to 4 is more apparently relevant and therefore easier to understand, well, at least for most of us. This transition is described in the stanzas of Zan, stanza 3, verse 4, note those numbers, The Secret Doctrine by HPB. HPB is Helena Blavatsky, for you new students, who was the, I would place her as the greatest esotericist of the 19th century, and she wrote The Secret Doctrine. So, to break the ice, let's get a volunteer to read this passage. I'm going to be asking for lots of volunteer readers today, so please don't be shy. And I would appreciate as quick a response as possible to volunteering to read, because we have a lot of material to cover. Also, reading helps other attendees get to know who you are. So, first volunteer. Joe, do we have anyone?
Not anyone yet, but I could call on someone, I suppose. Keith. Keith is ready. I'm going to unmute you, Keith.
Welcome.
There you go. Keith, we have unmuted you. Are you ready?
Hello, everyone. Then the three.
Go ahead.
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Then the three fall into the four.
You're cutting out, Keith. That sounds like we lost him. At least I did.
Yes, we did.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and read this one passage, and then there'll be plenty of other opportunities. Then the three fall into the four. The radiant essence becomes seven inside, seven outside. The luminous egg, which in itself is three, curdles and spreads in milk-white curds throughout the depths of the mother, the root that grows in the depths of the ocean of life. Okay. For those of you new to the stanzas of Zahn, they can be found at the beginning of The Secret Doctrine by Blavatsky, HBB, which is what she preferred to be called. Wasn't she gorgeous? And an entire different set at the beginning of A Treatise on Cosmic Fire by Alice Bailey. Both of these writings are available online. Time spent contemplating these potent, concentrated, enigmatic, and yet searingly beautiful ancient writings will be well repaid. So, what's going on in this stanza? The milk-white curds are primordial star stuff. The curds can be seen, for instance, as the Milky Way. References to churning the sea of milk to produce these curds is found in many early Hindu sources and is, in fact, one reason why cows are revered in India. I'm not sure this particular cow is all that happy with the attention, but there you have it. Better than being eaten, I guess. Okay, the phrase, the depths of mother, represents primordial space, that cosmic entity from which stars are nurtured. HBB tells us all the gods of antiquity are sons of this dark mother. The Black Madonna, in fact, most dark-faced goddesses, represent this primordial feminine deity that nurtures all of manifestation. But the phrase we'll focus on right now is the three fall into four. As we've discovered in previous webinars, threeness, which expresses itself through the triangle, represents the three aspects of deity, Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit in the West, the threefold Godhead in the East, and will, love, wisdom, and intelligent activity in the ancient wisdom teachings. They all represent variations on the same theme. The fall into four is a fall into form, and is called a fall because of the sense of separation embodiment or moving into form creates. Cosmically, the very first fall was the appearance of divine thought from the realm of pure being, which carried within it the idea or potential structure of form, rather than what we normally understand as form. For from the perspective of deity, an idea is a form, and the first and highest level of the form world is divine thought. Now, divine thought presumes the divine mind, whose manifested purpose is to reflect itself into all creation, which is an ongoing process, still going on today. That's the purpose and process of evolution. On our planet, we find this theme in the story of Lucifer and the fallen angels who brought the fire of mind to humanity. The third principle of intelligent activity, penetrating the fourth kingdom, ruled by the fourth ray. I hardly need to point out that this fall was a sacrificial rather than an evil act, as it is often portrayed. I literally scanned the web trying to find a positive understanding of this sacrifice of the Lucifer, the great angel from Venus, and this is as close as I got. Okay, we find this same sacrifice playing out in the myth of Prometheus, chained to the rock of physical incarnation. Both represent the transition from 3 to 4, the third aspect of deity falling or infusing the form world. Of course, this infusing process is relative. That is to say, the dividing line between formlessness and form is ever determined by one's level of consciousness. For example, the realm of Adi, called the Sea of Fire, is from the human perspective pure spirit, but for the solar logos, it's only the highest expression of its own physical plane. Okay, let's rejoin the third stanza at verse 7. I'm going to try to get a reader again. So please.
Before that, I see Harriet's hand up. Let's Great. See if she has a question or a comment. Hi, Harriet.
Oh, hi.
Thank you, Harriet.
I mean, I would love to know more. I'm getting reverberation. I'd like to know more about the concept of karma.
Well, actually, we're going to be looking at that a little later on in the webinar. So if you can hold on, I'll be covering it down the line a bit, if that's okay.
Thank you.
Okay. You bet. Thanks for participating. While we have you online, could I ask you to read this verse 7 of the third stanza?
Let me see if I can get it. Okay. The one is 4, and 4 takes to itself 3, and the union produces the Sapta, which is 7. Behold him lifting the veil and unfurling it from east to west. He shuts out the above and leaves the below to be seen as the great illusion. He marks the places for the shining ones and turns the upper into a shoreless sea of fire and the one manifested into the great waters.
Thank you, Harriet. Where are you in the world?
Los Angeles, California.
Oh, great. Ah, terrific. Okay, well, thank you. This graphic depiction describes the fundamental division that occurs during and only during periods of Manvantaric manifestation. Manvantaric just means a cosmic cycle of time and space manifestation. And the numbers that represent this division are 3, describing the fiery above, and 4, which describes the watery below. As revealed by the geometry associated with this verse, which can be created through the Vesca Pisces, as shown here, this middle line is that which separates the above, of itself a triangle, but when mirrored downward or fallen becomes the square. It's important to understand that this geometry actually exists on causal levels and is not just a metaphor. Now, our attempts to describe what these metaphors or these numbers represent employ metaphors, but the geometry itself stands in a causal relationship to anything we might say about them. This is why meditating on certain symbols and geometric forms can open the door to causal consciousness. We get some insight into how this causal geometry conditions its environment from Alice Bailey's Telepathy and the Etheric Vehicle. It's a small book that she wrote through Dual Cool. So, dare I ask, could we get another volunteer to read this? Any takers, Joe?
We have Keith again. Let's
try you, Keith.
I will try again. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
Great. The intersecting energies in the etheric body of the planet are at this time a network of squares. When the creative process is complete and evolution has done its work, these squares will become a network of triangles. This transformation of the square into the triangle has no reference whatsoever to the transmitted energies or to the various centers, except insofar that it becomes far easier for the energies to flow through the triangular formation of the etheric body than it is to flow, as is now the case, through or around a square and a network of squares.
Thanks, Keith. I forget, where are you? You're back east somewhere.
We're in the middle of a nice storm.
Oh, are you in the middle of an ice storm?
Yes.
Okay, well, good luck on that. So we have here a practical hint given in purely geometric terms as to why form-oriented consciousness, which is associated with the square, seems to be separate from and have limited access to the spiritual realms. You see what I mean? Because when these etheric web of the planet is reconstituted into a series of triangles instead of a series of squares, the spirit energy will naturally flow into all the etheric forms far more easily. This coincides with the becoming of a sacred planet, in the career of a planet. But let's get back to this symbol. When we add a vertical line, we have the symbol of the third logos. Remember the line from stanza 3, 4 takes to itself 3, whose union produces the 7? This refers to the function of the third logos as the agent of active intelligence and thus of manifestation. The 3 manifesting as or falling into 4 via the 7 electrical qualities of Fohad, which are instrumental in the creating of the 7 planes of manifestation. You may remember that Fohad is described as 7 great cosmic brothers, each carrying a particular quality of electrical force, which animates each of the subplanes of the cosmic physical plane. But note the wording of this verse. 4 takes to itself 3. Instead of what we might expect, 3 takes to itself 4. Any thoughts as to why this passage is phrased in this way? Think about this. We've been working from above downwards, so it would seem as though 3 takes to itself 4. In other words, spirit takes to itself the form world. But this verse suggests that, in fact, 4 takes to itself 3. So do we have any ideas, any thoughts? It's a tough question, but I thought maybe somebody out there might have some idea about this. Do we have any takers, Joe?
No one that has popped up since you framed the question. We have someone, I think, who's ready to read has a question. How about Guadalupe? Do you still have something you'd like to ask, or I'll unmute you?
I was going to read.
Okay,
well, great. Thanks very much. Just hang out there, and we'll have you read in a moment. Okay, I'll I'll go ahead with this this myself. To me, it suggests the nature of the dynamics between 3 and 4. Before form, or fourness, can receive the impress of spirit, that form, whatever it may be, must become negatively polarized or receptive to spirit, thus drawing into itself the influence of threeness. So, you know, we read that the soul meditates on its incarnation, but until the form, the incarnate being, repolarizes towards spirit, there's little that the soul can do to impress itself on the form. Okay, let's make a simple modification in this symbol. If we connect the vertical arm of the cross to the horizontal, a line that involutionally describes the fall and evolutionally indicates the mounting of the cross, we also have one way of writing the number 4, don't we? Furthermore, this diagonal implies the square that binds the cross. So our simple character for the number 4 is actually comes from an esoteric symbol. The relationship between the two arms of the cross being one of the most revealing symbols of the qualities of the number 4, is found in rays and initiations. Okay, Guadalupe, now you're on first for, or you're on home plate to read this.
Thank you. In the cross is hidden light. The vertical and horizontal in mutual friction create. A vibrant cross scintillates and motion originates. When the vertical assumes the horizontal, pralaya supervenes. Evolution is the movement of the horizontal to the upright positiveness. In the secret of direction lies the hidden wisdom. In the drip doctrine of absorption lies the healing faculty. In the point becoming the line, and the line becoming the cross is evolution. In the cross swinging to the horizontal lies salvation and pralaya peace.
Thank you, Guadalupe. Appreciate that. And tell us again where you're calling from. You've mentioned before.
Victoria, Canada.
That's right.
In Canada.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Okay. There's a lot going on here in this verse. Anyone have any thoughts on this extremely concentrated and occult commentary? Any ideas at all? Okay, I'm going to start describing what I've seen in this. If you have some thoughts along the way, please put your hand up and Joe will call on you. First we have, in the cross is hidden light. One name for the mutable cross is the hidden Christ. So do you see the reference there, the connection? In the cross is hidden light, and the mutable cross has the hidden Christ, and the Christ nature is light. That is to say, fourness, here represented by the cross, covers or occludes the light of spirit. This is one of the esoteric meanings behind solar and lunar eclipses. The next phrase is, the vertical and horizontal arms of the cross in mutual friction create. A vibrant cross scintillates and motion originates. We can look at the phrase motion originates from a macrocosmic, that means cosmic, perspective, having to do with the cyclic motion characterizing the beginning of the Manvantara, or from the point of view of the evolving unit of consciousness, that, like ourselves, to which evolution is the movement of the horizontal to upright positiveness. So reference to the point, line, and cross can also be seen macrocosmically, as representing the entire involutional evolutional arc, or again, from the point of view of the evolving unit of consciousness, ourselves, i.e. the point representing successive lives of personality integration, the line representing the coming into awareness of the other, and the influence of the soul, which finally leads onto one of the three progressive crosses. Actually, it always leads to the first of the three progressive crosses, and the ever more refined struggle with the pairs of opposites represented by the two arms of the cross. Okay, as a final comment on this passage, the three crosses, before I get into that, did anybody step forward? Joe, do we have any comments on this?
We haven't seen any hands go up and no questions.
Not yet. Okay. So as a final comment on this passage, the three crosses, which we'll be taking up in detail a little later, seem to be alluded to in the progression from the horizontal arm relating to the mutable cross, the vertical arm relating to the fixed cross, and what seems to be a higher octave or return to the horizontal arm relating to the cardinal cross. Remember, DK says, in the cross swinging to the horizontal lies salvation and prolific peace.
Orest put his hand up.
Yes, Orest. Hello, how are you?
Hello. In the context of this, the axes of crystals and matter are implied, and the creative process is implied, the creation of matter.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, yes, indeed. The entire creative aspect implies duality. And the vertical arm, which is, we normally connect with the effort to achieve alignment with the higher forces, so is inherently dualistic, right? So this is, and is also inheritively creative. Well, it also works the other way around, that the white magician in the creating of the great thought forms that transform our race is working on this vertical arm of the cross. Okay. But let's talk for a moment about this horizontal arm. The return to the horizontal arm at the level of the third cross seems enigmatic, the cardinal cross, unless we take into account the fact that these three phases or three crosses may represent an alternating move from unity to duality and back to unity. First, the horizontal of personality integration, which is the move towards unity, and then the vertical of soul personality duality, and finally true unity gained through the mystery of identification, once again represented by the horizontal arm of the cross. It's like alternating current, right? And from very high levels may be seen just in that way. Okay, the influence of the rays is inextricably tied up in this progression between the two arms of the cross. This illustration is by Dwayne Carpenter, a terrific esotericist. He has a wonderful website. I urge you to Google his name, Dwayne Carpenter, and see his wonderful illustrations and read his terrific material. He's quite an esotericist and fellow artist. Okay, the essentially cardinal first, second, and third rays of aspect can be seen as making up the horizontal arm of the cross. And the fourth through seventh rays of attribute, because they lead to the mounting of the cross and are thus associated with the first four initiations, make up the vertical arm. This arrangement works especially well if we shift our paradigm to an unfolded cube, like you see here, with three overshadowing four at the central point. That is, by the way, the enlightened or macrocosmic point of view from beneath, or from the point of view of the aspirant, you would see the fourth ray, the yellow, overshadowing the green of the third ray. Or I should say, not overshadowing, but blocking or occluding it. Okay, the great lord of the third ray is called the Lord of Civilization. He wields the four rays of attribute in connection with each of the four kingdoms in nature, which at least on our planet is the great quaternary, and in fact makes up the entire manifested world. Right, so one ray each for each of the realms or the kingdoms of nature, the fourth ray being human, fifth the animal, sixth the plant, and seventh the mineral kingdom. DK says, the life of the triangles may penetrate the area of the square and produce the inevitable consequence, the germinating of ideas and the flowering of a new civilization and culture. Keeping in mind the injunction, as above, so below, let's shift our focus to soul and personality, to how the three of the spiritual triad affects the lower quaternary, which is the manifested realm. In ourselves, it's the incarnated form. DK describes this spiritual triplicity as that which hovers over the square and radiates the energy of light into this waiting field of active thought. Joe, I'm getting a noise coming through. Could you try to find the source of that? Well, it yes. went away. So, okay. In order to align with this light, DK recommends meditating on this particular series of symbols. And he suggests that we do that theoretically, visually, practically, intuitionally, and factually. Whenever he gives a list like that, it's not just random. He's suggesting a very specific process of approach with that. Anyway, this illustration is taken directly from the books, from his description of this meditation. So let's take a few moments to develop our understanding of the last two of these symbols. You see there on the far right, here they are reproduced. And to do this, we'll use the approach Dwal Kool outlines in the introduction to Glamour, a World Problem, which we've used in the past to analyze symbols. So I very much hope that you'll jump in and participate on this segment of the webinar, because that's the nature of these three approaches to analyzing the symbol as group participation. So you may remember that DK divides this approach into three segments, beginning with the exoteric approach. So he tells us that exoterically, this involves a study of its form as a whole, of its lines, and therefore of its numerical significance, and also a study of its sectional forms, by which I mean its arrangements. So what can we say about the lines, the numerical significances, and the arrangement of the forms that make up these two figures? At this point, we're not looking for meaning or significance, but rather for simple tabulation of this figures or these two figures' physical attributes. I'd love to have you participate. And new students, don't be shy. If you see something, speak up. When called on, please briefly describe some single physical attribute. Your observation may seem obvious, like the ones listed here. That's fine. In fact, that's what we're looking for, the simple qualities of the physical attributes of these two symbols. So I've started us off with 2 points to kind of get you going with the sense of what we're looking for. First is, let me finish this first, just a sec. Both figures contain a triangle and an implied square. That's the first one. The second is, whereas the square remains the same in both figures, the two triangles point in opposite directions. Okay, so further thoughts. Did I hear you say that Martin has his hand up?
Yes.
Great. What you got, Martin?
I was just going to point out the number six. There's six lines in each.
That's correct. Yes, indeed. Making a total of 12. Thank you. Any more?
Jocelyn.
Hi, Jocelyn.
Hello, Francis.
I
would like to know why the apex of each triangle does not reach, you know, the base on the left side and the top on the right side. It seems that there's a partial descent and a partial ascent on each one. So
yes,
why is that so?
Well, we'll look at the why in the second portion of this. Right now, just the fact that you're pointing that out is, we'll call that a physical attribute, because it's true that when you bring these two figures together, the triangle does not completely separate the area that's held by the square. So thanks for that, Jocelyn, and we will look at that.
Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Helen shared something in the question box. Helen, can you speak? I guess not. Helen
okay.
says all of the lines have a parallel in the other diagram.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very interesting. Yeah, I see. Yeah, that's good. All right. The two triangles, of course, the squares are two parallel lines, but the two triangles have opposite parallels. Very interesting. Thank you. That's
Iris.
Also one. Yeah, Iris.
Hello, Francis. This may seem very obvious, but the energy
good.
Of the one on the left goes down, and the energy of the one on the right goes up.
Right, suggested by the two triangles. Mm. Yeah, in other words, they're, you know, to keep it strictly physical, the pointing suggests that that's the direction of movement. So yes, thank you, Iris. Any others? Jewel, we're on a roll here, so if you see anything else, jump in. Okay, I'll start describing what I have. And if something else occurs to you any time along the way, Joe, interrupt me, and we'll go to whoever, okay?
We had one more comment come in
good.
From Constance. The triangles are equilateral. She doesn't have a mic, that's why she's...
Oh, I see. Yes, they are indeed equilateral triangles. Thank you for that. Okay. In the first figure, an M can be traced. Okay, that's a strictly physical attribute, right? In either figure, the triangle, as Jocelyn says, doesn't quite separate the square into two parts. In each figure, as was that? Was that a rest? No. Was that a rest? It was, wasn't it? I can't remember who said this. Are six lines of equal length. That was pointed out. Okay, now six equal length lines rearranged form either a six-pointed star or a hexagon. The two symbols together have 12 lines, which is a number of completion. But in fact, what we have here is seven lines in each figure, right? But one is common, so we have six. Seventh is a very often a hidden line. All right. Now, if the penetrating lines of either triangle were extended until they intersected the opposite side of the square, like in the first figure there to the left, they would create two slightly overlapping right triangles, which if placed back to back would create an equilateral triangle of their own. When combined, okay, that's, here's another point. When combined, the two figures that we've been discussing, the up and down pointing triangles, create an interior diamond. That's, you see that on your left, which is itself made up of two equilateral triangles, from which a vesica piscis can be created, thus revealing the form or opening the door to the form generating capacities of the vesica piscis. So, while I was speaking, were there any additional thoughts that came to the fore? Anybody have any ideas? Any more ideas about the physical attributes? Okay, then let's move on to the second of Dwell Kuhl's methods for understanding a symbol. Let's get a reader for this. Can we get a volunteer, please? Somebody we haven't heard from, could you jump forward?
Claire, great. You had volunteered.
Hi there, Francis. Hi, everyone.
Hi, Claire.
I want to make one comment, if that's okay, about just what we've been previously talking about before reading. Is that all right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just how beautiful this is. And also, just seeing the square as the container and the triangle as the sort of focus of concentrated energy within that container was
yes,
just
indeed.
To me. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. A friend of mine, we were talking about the whole idea of form and spirit, and we realized that there really is no form that is not imbued with consciousness. That when you have spirit, when you bring spirit and form together, they will always create a consciousness. There is no such thing as, you know, a separated, uninformed form, right? So, yes, thank you for that. And could you read this section, please?
Sure. B, conceptually, this involves arriving at its underlying idea, which may be expressed in its name. At its meaning as that emerges in the consciousness through meditation, and at its significance as a whole. Oops, the slide's...
I'm sorry. Sorry about that. I was on the wrong. Go ahead.
And significance as a whole or in part. You should, when doing this, bear in mind that the idea connotes the higher or abstract intent, that the meaning is that intent expressed in terms of the concrete mind, and that its significance has in it more of an emotional quality and might be expressed as the type of desire it arouses in you.
Thank you, Claire. The DK ascribes meaning to the concrete mind and significance to the emotional realm, and we're going to consider both of those, meaning and significance, during this portion. So, considering our list of physical attributes, what meaning or significance can we ascribe to these two symbols? You may wish to keep in mind the traditional esoteric meaning and significance of the equilateral triangle and the square when you're considering these two figures. By now, I'm sure you become aware of the fact that the triangle is associated with spirit and the square with form. In fact, DK tells us about the square that four lunar lords constitute what the ageless wisdom teaching calls the four sides of the square. They are the lower quaternary, the imprisoning cubes, or the cross upon which the inner spiritual man is to be crucified. So the inner spiritual man, of course, could be associated with the triangle there. Okay, to help us get comfortable with this mode of thinking, I've listed a single subjective attribute. These two symbols represent two progressive stages of the effect of spirit on the world of form. So, any further ideas about the meaning and significance of these two figures? If there are any Masons in attendance, Please feel free to contribute ideas specifically relevant to masonry, at least any ideas that you can share without being ritually drawn and quartered. So, Joe, any takers, masons or otherwise?
Martin's hand went up right away, and then we have another comment from Guadalupe after Martin.
Great.
Yeah, basically, I got the image of Gemini and Sagittarius, and the descending arrow pointing down. Mm. I saw the right and the left of that square as the two poles of the glyph of Gemini, the right and left of Gemini, and Gemini governs the etheric. So it's the descent of spirit into the etheric realm or into the true physical. And on the other side, the point upward appeared to me as to be the point of the arrow of a Sagittarius rising out of matter. So in one sense, it's the descent into the etheric by spirit and the ascent out of matter by one-pointedness of Sagittarius or the intuition.
That's really terrific. Thanks for that. Yeah, great. So for those of you who may be unaware of the fact that Sagittarius and Gemini are opposite poles of the same axis, and you can see that quality is inherent in these two forms. You know, the triangles or points are in fact pointing in opposite directions. So yes, I like that very much. Also, Gemini is the third sign, so we have the three pointing downwards or moving into the form realm, which is finally manifested in Cancer and represents the etheric, the other. So you have the opposition of the two forms of the other, which is the square and the triangle. Yes. I very much appreciate that. Thank you. Anyone else?
We have Guadalupe, and then Keith also has his hand up too.
Great.
Yes. Yes, the previous speaker talked about the arrow of Sagittarius. Mm-hmm. I did not connect it with Gemini, but thank you. But I also saw the transfer strictly the form. In the first one is spirit descending into form. In the second one, spirit form ascending into spirit.
I see. Yes, yes, yes. Right. Yeah, the very... so you're actually shifting the nature so that in the second one, the triangle becomes the form, right? Ascending
from the base, that is the base of the square, the form, spirit ascends.
Right.
That's my interpretation.
I see, yes. Terrific insight, yes. Great, thank you for that.
And before we head to Keith, there's a comment that Constance shared. The ascending triangle represents aspiration or penetration into the higher. The descending represents impression from the higher spheres.
Yes, yes, indeed. Right, you start to get a feel. We're starting to get a feel, aren't we, for the quality of these two primary shapes when they are shown in combination. And of course, this isn't just our idea. This is put forward by Dwal Kul as a point of reference in meditation. So, okay, how about any other ideas on this? We're on a good roll. I'm very impressed with the comments so far.
Keith and then Jocelyn.
Okay, Keith.
In terms of the Masonic apron, I think it's not revealing anything because it's pretty common knowledge that the entered apprentice comes in with the triangle folded down over the square, and it, as the as you work your way through the degrees, the triangle that's folded down is then unfolded and sits atop the square.
Yes. Okay.
And in terms of the symbol right before then of the squares, I think if we looked at it in a different way, it doesn't have to. Right. It doesn't have to be the triangle sitting atop the squares. It also could be the squares that have kind of trapped the triangle. So it's the triangle within the square, not necessarily that it's sitting, you know, atop the square like the Masonic apron.
Right, right. Yeah, this is, you know, the geometry always stands in a causal relationship to anything we might say about it, right? And so the idea is that these different configurations of the same two figures stimulate further response in us. So, yeah, exactly. Thanks for that, Keith. And Jocelyn.
Yes, this is very good, Keith. It's more a process of infusion. We see this in motion, where one interpenetrates the other. Mm. I was going to say another thing it represents, we could go on for a long time here, is the redemption of matter on the left side, where you have the triplicity redeeming the four lunar lords, the triplicity being the triad, or we can insert there the soul as the intermediary between the square and the triangle, which we're not showing here. And on the other side, it seems that redeemed matter then aspires evolutionary to its next level of expression.
Mm. Yes, indeed.
Also, if you open the flap on the left side, then it, referring to the science of triangles, then it becomes the emanating point, directing the energies into the square.
Yes.
And then if you open the flap on the right side, then you have the point of distribution, which is the service that is expressed by the redeemed quaternary. So the quaternary in service, there's a point of distribution for that energy.
Yes, a field
of
service. So
we can open the flaps both sides.
Mm, indeed. Yes, it's brilliant, Jocelyn. Thank you so much. Okay, any other comments?
Leah, and then we have a written comment, unless Tanya's audio is going to work for us. So Leah, go ahead.
Thank you. Just a simple basic fact that with these two particular diagrams, you can't look at them as separate. You're drawn inexorably, I think, to create union through the two. You simply cannot keep them separate.
Yes, I see what you mean. Indeed. That gets to, let's see, this idea on the left. That's the two in union. Is that what you meant, Leah? Or just the juxtaposition of the two?
Yes.
Okay.
No. Yes, that it leads you forward. Your word progressive in your first point there is really important.
I see. Yes, indeed. Yes, they are, in my mind, they represent two stages of you know, two progressive stages of the effect of spirit on the world of form. It's just, you know, how do we determine what those are? So any other thoughts on this?
There's a question that Tanya put in to you. Do the flags of Volpi or Volpi have this spiritual meaning? They do bring a lot of joy when used as flags.
Well, you know, I can't answer that. Is there anyone, what is it, Volpe? Volts?
V-O-L-P-I.
Volpe. Okay. Is anyone familiar with that who could answer this question? Sorry, I'm not familiar with the term. I will look it up. So thanks for that comment. Okay. Here's some additional thoughts. If you continue to have thoughts, raise your hand. We'll call on you. But for the time being, I'll go ahead with some thoughts on my own. The combination of spirit and form always creates consciousness. I was just discussing this with Claire. Therefore, this intersecting triangle and square can be seen as a symbol for an aspirant or disciple in some specific stage of spiritual development. The downpointing triangle suggests involution, upward-pointing triangle evolution. These are very simple, but all of it needs to be stated. The difference in placement of the shared line of contact, okay, wait a minute, let me catch up with myself here. Here we go. The difference in placement of the shared line of contact in these two figures suggests a difference in the relationship between spirit and form. The square with the upward-pointing triangle could be seen as representing aspiration. That's the one on the right. And the square with the down-pointing triangle, the soul's response to that aspiration. That seems pretty straightforward, and a couple of you have mentioned this quality. Alternately, if we bump it up a level, the fact the baseline in the first image is that of the square could suggest a personality-oriented consciousness strongly influenced by the down-pointing soul. Here, the shared line of contact is the upper edge of the square in the realm of the soul. But in this scenario, soul influence hasn't reached the baseline, which could be seen as representing the root chakra. That comment, I hope, helps answer subjectively your observation, Jocelyn. So if we accept this idea as a hypothesis, the second image would represent the soul-infused personality because the baseline of both the triangle and the square are now one. Here we have the soul fully expressing itself in the three worlds of human endeavor. The triangle is now pointing upwards towards the monad, but there is still a square and thus a personality, suggesting that the fourth initiation has not as yet been taken. The point that I want to make with the above contrasting examples is that two opposing interpretations can be represented by the same geometry. There isn't just one meaning to any geometry. And that's okay because numbers, symbols, and geometry always stand in a causal relationship to anything we may say about them. And that's part of their beauty. Okay, since form and spirit are relative terms, these combined symbols could represent an entity at any stage of development, higher or lower than the idea of soul and personality. For instance, an animal approaching individualization, or a master approaching union with the monad, or even the lord of civilization stimulating all the four kingdoms of nature. In Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2, Dwal Kul gives us another example of the relationship between the triangle and the square. So could I get a reader for this short passage? Anyone volunteer? Just impulsively, randomly punch the button. God knows what's going to happen.
We have a volunteer. Yay. And I may mispronounce her name. Is it Clesia? You're muted. You've muted yourself, Lucia. Okay. So try unmuting. There you go.
Great.
Good evening.
Good evening.
My name is
Clesia.
Clesia.
Clesia. Thank you.
I think this is the middle part.
Okay. Could you read this, please?
Yes. One significance of the triangle is that it stands for the triplicity of 1, the ashram, 2, the soul on its own plane, 3, the disciple upon the physical plane, whilst the square represents humanity, which is frequently spoken of as a city which stands four square.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Clesia. Appreciate it. Now he goes on to say, in considering the higher points of the triangle, which is the ashram, this is directly related, I would remind you that radiation from Shambhala enters the triangle at that point, and that through the ashram will purpose, and strength can pour. Later in this passage, he describes the square thusly. We will regard the square for the purpose of our work. This point was brought forward by Jocelyn, as the field of service and of experience, thus suggesting that we hold our consciousness within the realm of the triangle. Okay, do we have any additional thoughts on the meaning and significance of these figures before we move on? I think we've covered it pretty well. Some great comments. Thanks very much. I very much appreciate the astrological point with Gemini and Sagittarius. That's very helpful. Okay, let's tackle Dwal Kul's third phase in the contemplation of a symbol. Could we get a reader for this little short passage?
Yes, and I'll while we're waiting for a volunteer, just share Malia said, numerologically, the M and the W are both fours. And she had had a comment before, the one on the right looked like a W as the one on the left did an M.
Wow, that is terrific. Do you see what she's saying? Numerologically, okay, M is the 13th letter. So 1 and 3 add to 4. That's terrific. And I haven't figured out, okay, W, C, X, Y, Z, W, X, Y, Z, that makes it 26, 25, 24, 23, 22. The 22nd letter, yes, adds to 4. That's brilliant. Thanks very much. It's amazing what's hidden in these. You think you've got it all, and there you have it. That's just great. Okay, a reader, please, for this last part of the consideration of the symbol.
I could call on Lynn Darnell. Lynn, are you awake? Yes, it should be. Let's see if Lynn can tune in. Sometimes she...
It's relatively painless to read, folks. I mean, it's, you know, it's not too tough.
Hi, Lynn. Are you there? We're getting a little...
Okay, some people may not have a headset.
Right.
Yeah, and that does create problems. But I ask...
Ah, Leah volunteers, so here
okay,
you go.
Okay, Leah, great. Thank you.
Unmute yourself, Leah.
Right. Esoterically, this would cover the effect of the force or energy upon you and of the quality of the vibration it may arouse in you, perhaps, in some center, perhaps in your astral body, or perhaps only in your mind.
Mm. Thank you. So, having familiarized ourselves with these two figures, let's seize the moment and reflect on where in ourselves they affect us. Keep in mind as you visualize that symbols, rather than being descriptions of potencies, are inherently potent. Thus, they have the potential to penetrate your consciousness and reveal their essential selves. We're going to take exactly 1 minute for this meditation, starting right now. Okay, so now I'm going to ask you to keep in mind what we've learned about the triangle and the square as we look at the third and fourth tarot arcana, the Empress, which is associated with the planet Venus, and the Emperor, associated with Aries, exoterically ruled by Mars and esoterically ruled by Mercury. These two arcana will help us put a face on our understanding of the relationship between the numbers 3 and 4. One theory has it that the tarot arcana are arranged sequentially in terms of primacy. So, what is the meaning of the feminine standing above the masculine as suggested by the order of these tarot arcana? Any ideas based on what we've discussed? Why would the Empress stand in a causal relationship to the Emperor? If you have any ideas, you can respond. Joe, do we have any takers?
Not one yet.
Okay, I'll be discussing this for a little bit, so keep thinking about it, and if an idea occurs to you, raise your hand. Okay, one interpretation suggests that the feminine Empress represents the receptive quality of yin, and the masculine Emperor the active quality of yang. When we as disciples have repolarized our higher and lower centers, the head, heart, and throat chakras become negatively polarized and thus receptive to the influence of the soul. The now positively polarized lower centers then become a means by which to radiate the light of the soul, to serve, and gain further experience. The higher chakras, represented by the receptive feminine Empress, channel energy down to the Emperor, the active, intelligent server. We have a visual representation of this downpouring stream in the Emperor's scepter, which, as you can see, is a modified symbol of Venus, as well as the scepter of Venus, which carries the symbol of the Emperor. There's something very mysterious about scepters, and just their physical quality suggests a line of force, or an alignment. But you can see that the symbol that the Emperor is holding there on the right is identical to the symbol that stands atop the Empress's scepter. In fact, the Emperor doesn't become to be an emperor, that is to say, master of himself and his environment, until he repolarizes his chakras and is thus capable of receiving the impress of the spiritual triad, which passes through the Empress to him. As a result of this repolarization, he comes under the esoteric rulership of Mercury, a fourth ray sacred planet, thus beginning his preparation for an initiation lying far ahead, in which he becomes the divine hermaphrodite. For remember, Hermes is Mercury and Aphrodite is Venus. So Hermes, Aphrodite, hermaphrodite is the union of these two great forces. The Emperor sits upon a cubic stone, as does the Empress, one side on which is carved an eagle with outstretched wings, representing spirit manifesting in the lower quaternary. This is similar to an actual historical example of a true emperor, shown in this, my favorite of all ancient sculptures, which depicts Horus overshadowing the pharaoh Chephren. Another sculpture of this great pharaoh shows him with his empress, who is supporting him from behind and striding forth in step with him. The striding suggests active outer expression, the integrated feminine masculine, the 3 and 4, moving as the one who is 7, right? 3 and 4 add to 7, and yet they move as one. Note that they both step forward with their left foot, the foot associated with the feminine aspect. Those of you interested in the Tarot may find this passage from the book The Tarot by Paul Foster Case illuminating. The emperor is essentially identical with a magician after the latter's union with a high priestess has transformed her into the empress and has made him the father of her children. So whenever you're talking about children, you're talking about the descent into form. Yeah. So this interpretation is strengthened by the fact that the magician is the personification of Mercury, which is the emperor's esoteric ruler, and thus conditions his higher self. So we have the genesis of 1 and 2 into 3 and 4. You could just draw a zigzag line through there, right? The magician and the high priestess reflecting themselves into the form world as the emperor and the empress, and the empress and the emperor. But what happens? Anybody notice what happens when you get this embodiment or this shift down into form? Anybody see something that goes on with this shift? Anybody? Do you see any kind of a change that happens as a result of this shift?
We have a hand up. Guadalupe, you're unmuted.
Yeah, Guadalupe.
One very obvious is that in the first one, it is masculine to feminine, and in the second, it reverts to feminine to masculine.
Exactly. The one becomes four, the four in one, and the abstract two of wisdom becomes the three of active intelligence. So you have this mirroring downward, and often we read that the higher realms mirror themselves down into the realms of the form world, right? Thank you, Guadalupe. That's great. Okay.
Asha just shared a comment. She says, it puts a new meaning to the expression, behind every man there's a woman.
Yes, it does. Yes, indeed. Yes. It's the more esoteric meaning of the phrase, isn't it? Okay, and the example we're going to look at next will, it's further strengthen what that example. Thanks for that. Let's look at one last example of the supremacy of the Empress, the three standing in a causal relationship to the four. The great knight Gawain, notice his shield with the upper pointing triangle and the sense of the fourness down below. He was from King Arthur's court and was betrothed by the king to the loathsomely ugly Dame Ragnielle. Their marriage was necessary as a result of the twists and turns of the story in order to save King Arthur's life. Now, Gawain approached his wedding as an act of sacrifice for the good of his king, and all attending were sorrowful as though at a funeral. But when he carried his new bride across the threshold of their home, determined to do his duty as husband and provider, because this was not a sham, he truly took this on. Gawain was astonished to see Ragnielle transformed into a great beauty. She then told them that he had a choice. Either she could remain beautiful all night, every night, or all day, every day. After some deliberation, Gawain said to Ragnielle, but wait a minute, which would you choose if you were in this situation? It's a tough choice, isn't it? All day, every day, or all night, every night? Anyway, he said, you are sovereign. Do as you will. He gave her the choice. Raniel then said, oh, in that case, I choose to be beautiful both day and night. With this, Gawain passed a great test given him by his enlightened king, a self-realized emperor, right? And administered by Raniel, who thus became for Gawain, as the Empress Arcanum is to the emperor. So yes, the woman standing behind the man, indeed. If we see marriage to Raniel as representing the union with the soul, Gawain's recognition of her sovereignty allows the beauty of the soul to overshadow both their lives. And that's the meaning behind her making the choice she made. In so doing, Gawain moves from the separative influence of the non-sacred planet Mars to the enlightened guidance of esoteric and sacred Mercury. Okay, we've been discussing the triangle overshadowing the square, one of two great concepts concerning the number four. The other is four as the midway point. Dual Kuhl says, what master has explained the purpose of the hierarchical intent as the merging of the higher with the lower triangle and their fusion in the square? So you see, the whole nature of the square now shifts from being the at the bottom and representing the form, the lower quaternary, to that place at the center. It's a very different understanding. They're related concepts, however, because that place in the center is the highest of the lower. Okay, so this square in this context is the fourth subplane, which stands in a position called the midway point. This is true of the entire physical cosmic plane, which is shown here, and it's true of any of its subplanes. This triangle square triangle sequence can be translated as 3-4-3, right? Which equals 7 × 7 × 7, which just happens to be the number of incarnations of a planetary logos during the entire Earth scheme. In addition to this, the number associated with Sanat Kumara is 777. We could call all this a numerical coincidence, but we're given evidence to the contrary in this quote from A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. Can we have a reader volunteer to read this section? Somebody who hasn't read yet, just push the button. It will hardly hurt at all. I know some of you out there.
We have a volunteer. Asha?
Hello, this is Asha.
Hi, Asha.
Hello. Just as each plane has its seven subplanes, so likewise each subplane can be subdivided, thus making 49 fires on every plane, or the 343 fires of the solar system. Herein can be found the clue to the mystery of the fourth between the three, which has at times bewildered students of the occult records. There are several ways of reading these figures, 3-4-3, but the only occult method which can be hinted at here lies in the recognition of the three higher planes, the three lower planes, and the fourth plane of meeting between them. This fourth plane has occultly been called the meeting place.
Thank you, Aisha. Appreciate that.
I just...
Yes, go ahead.
This is like amazing, fantastic, mind-boggling all at once, and yet it's resonating at a level I can't even articulate. But I'm thinking of the fourth plane as the heart chakra somehow.
Yes. Well, you know, the heart is very strongly connected with the four in many ways. Yes, it's the place at the center in terms of the, you know, the chakras of our own body, right? Is the fourth up and the fourth down, if you look at at the seven chakras. And DK tells us that, you know, these correlations are always relevant. You know, for instance, the fact that the heart is the fourth. So yes, yeah, your intuition is right on with that. Okay, the most important subplane to humankind, at least at this time and in our solar system, is the fourth subplane of the entire cosmic physical plane, called the Buddha plane, or the plane of the Christ principle. Since it stands at the midway point and is thus the four in the 3-4-3 of the cosmic physical plane, and is related to the heart center, it is the plane of union or at-one-ment, which is also a quality we think of in terms of the heart. The Tibetan tells us, when a man takes the fourth initiation, he functions in the fourth plane vehicle, that's the Buddhic, and has escaped permanently from the personality ring pass knot on the fourth subplane of the mental. This leads to the ability to dwell and to be active in the vehicle of the ego, who is the embodiment of the love and wisdom aspect of the monad. At the sixth initiation, a further at-one-ment takes place on the Buddhic plane, a blending of the qualities of the human and Deva kingdom to create the divine hermaphrodite, the union of the qualities of Venus and Mercury, as described in our discussion of the Empress and the Emperor. Then, 3 and 4 become, as I mentioned before, the 1 and 7, a true union. Okay, one reason that the fourth subplane is the plane of release is because we are in the fourth globe of the fourth earth round, of the fourth chain, which has as its goal the dominance of the fourth physical ether, which is the fourth subplane of the dense physical plane. The point here is not to remember all this info, but to notice how completely we are conditioned by the number 4. We're right in the middle of it all. By the way, the system of 7 globes and 7 rounds and 7 chains is another example of 3-4-3, right? Since 7 times 7 times 7 gives us 343 globes, the number of incarnations of our planetary logos, of which Sanat Kumara, the Lord of the world, is one of 343. So the tremendous importance of the fourth is not only true of our planet. In a treatise on cosmic fire, Dwal Kool tells us, here we are at the fourth ether on the physical plane. So anyway, Dwal Kool tells us, and we'd love to have a reader for this. Would somebody volunteer? Any takers? How about you, Gabrielle? Are you out there with a microphone? Could you step in on this? I know you're present today.
I can't unmute her.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't know why that is.
No mic, she says.
That's it. That's fine. Okay. Any other takers? We have a volunteer to read this. Okay, someone who's gone before, like Keith or whoever.
Keith, let's circle back to you. You read at the beginning. Can you open your mic, Keith?
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Our solar system is disclosed as being a system of the fourth order, having its four centers upon the fourth cosmic plane and making its objective manifestation from the fourth systemic plane via the fourth subplane of the systemic physical plane, a system formed of three fires which form a fourth, a system in which the bird has four tail feathers and hence can occultly mount to a higher plane and find its fifth, a system which has four major cycles and minor periods of manifestation, which are multiples of that figure. A system which in the alchemical phraseology of the masters is viewed as being a product of the fourth itself,
in process of transmutation, and the living stone with four shells.
Thank you, Keith. Okay. Appreciate that. Okay, you know, this isn't about all this. I'm not trying to inundate you with the deep waters of cosmic theosophy. The point here is to emphasize how thoroughly conditioned, not only at a planetary level, but on the level of the solar logos, how thoroughly conditioned we are by the midway point and by the number four. We are in the fifth root race on the fourth globe of the fourth round of the fourth chain. Thus, we are just one race beyond the absolute midpoint of the entire Earth scheme, right? The midpoint was Atlantis, a failed race. They never made it to the finish line. So we've just entered by one race. That's like 7 times 343, whatever that comes out to. That amount into the second half of the progress of the Earth scheme, right? Of the, you might say, the career of the Earth scheme. Nonetheless, having crossed that line is a momentous shift into evolutional progress and process, right? Now the entire energy shifts from the downward thrust of involution that was going on through the third root race, and then the static quality that occurred during Atlantis, which was responsible in part for its failure. And now here we are with the Aryan race, nothing to do with Hitler's Aryan race. It's a race that's existed in ancient Indian times. And the Aryan race with the fifth root race just beginning to come up into an entirely new phase of the Earth's history. Okay, so anyway, here's a less colorful, but probably somewhat more accurate depiction of the seven root races. You see here the first race, which is not even in physical form, and that second race plunged into form, and then the third race starts the process of coming around for the evolution. The fourth race was dead flat in the sense of its progression. And finally, here we are in the fifth race starting to evolve. And the sixth race, we have this dramatic shift of going upwards. And then finally, the culmination in the seventh race. Okay. All right.
Let's see. We have another comment from Asha.
Great. Asha.
I just noticed that 4 is also the first number that we skip in the Fibonacci sequence, which goes 1, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh, interesting.
Five.
Interesting.
Yeah, huh. and the prevalence of 4, like we have stable structures in the manifested world, the four legs in a chair, the windows, rectangles.
Yes.
Steiner always talked about, you know, the soft curves in architecture, and we always have rectangles and corners.
Yes.
I don't know what any of that means, but just...
Well, it's an eminently practical number, and it represents a kind of stasis, because it's the midway point, just like the fourth root race. It's the point of, in a sense, changelessness, which is why, of course, it doesn't... it's not included in the Fibonacci sequence. Naturally, it's not included, because if you were to reach 4, you would not be able to then progress out of it. So, yes, thanks for those comments. And I'm going to be discussing, by the way, because we're running out of time very rapidly here, I'm going to be discussing many of the ideas you just brought up in the next webinar. And fact, I think we're going to pull the plug right there and see, escape here and go down to, the reading list, because we're right at 3:30, and I know Some of you in Europe are up late and ready to go to bed, and some of you in Australia are possibly ready to go to work or at least get on with your day. So we won't delay you much longer. Let's see. The reading list. Chapters on the number 4 in the Key to the Universe, verses 1, it's volume 1, not verses, by Harriet and Homer Curtis. And the chapters on the number 4 in A Beginner's Guide to Conducting the Universe by Michael Schneider. I gave this assignment last time as a if you wanted to get ahead or catch up on your reading. Now they're really a part of the curriculum, you might say. And then pages 131 through 141 of Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2, which describes the meditation on the triangle and the square. Okay? And I'd like to close by intoning a, go back out of this mode here. Here we go. By intoning the mantra on the divine triangle and its influence on the square. So, I hope you've enjoyed today's webinar. Next month we'll complete our survey of the number 4, covering the color yellow, the Sephiroth called Chesed, that's the fourth Sephiroth in the Tree of Life. We'll also take a look at the tetrahedron, the first and strongest of the platonic solids, how form manifests in temple construction, and we'll take a look at astrology and many, many other topics at the next webinar. So for now, let's have this meditation together. So just stay silently to yourself or concentrate on this as I speak it. I'll start by intoning the Om. Om. In the center of the will of God, I stand. Naught shall deflect my will from His. I implement that will by love. I turn towards the field of service. I, the triangle divine, work out that will within the square and serve my fellow men. Om. Okay, well, that's it for today. Don't forget to donate a couple of bucks on MoriaFederation.com, which will help pay the yearly fee for this GoToMeeting account. Thanks to Brett, these webinars are available on Makara.us. Thanks, Joe, very much for your assistance today. I know they were big shoes to fill. You did it quite well. Thank you for that. And finally, keep spreading the word about this webinar series. Who knows, we might even make it to the number 10 by the end of the year. So thank you for attending, and I'll see you next time, which will be on February 15th, the day after Valentine's Day, right? Okay, so bye for now.